Shares. Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is all mining all the time. No, not really. But we are going to talk about mining today. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, is Dr. Anirban Mahanty. G'day, Doc.
G'day, Captain. What happened to mining?
We're going
to
talk about mining. We said last week we would, and despite the fact that this morning I had to say to you, what was it last week we said we'd talk about? And you said mining. That's right. So we are going to talk about mining this week, but our listeners will have to wait. How's that for a teaser?
Stay tuned.
We'll talk about mining first, though. We've got a pretty big roll call of stuff to get through, mate. We've got a lot happening in the market, around the markets. So let's kick it off. Just a quick teaser. We're going to talk about the big macro. We're going to talk about NAB, Flight Centre, Wesfarmers, mining, and which company is now worth more than AMP? Don't answer. I know you know.
Okay.
I'm going to keep that for our listeners as well.
That's a good question.
Let's get into it.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Let's start with the big macro, mate. There's kind of a bit going on around the markets, and it's all focused on next week when the RBA may or may not finally cut rates. Now, we talked about the 0% CPI a couple of weeks ago. Some believe, with some justification, that's put the frighteners up the RBA. They're so worried about deflation that we might yet see an election campaign rate cut, something we haven't seen since 2007 in John Howard's last campaign when Kevin Rudd won the prime ministership. And NAB is saying, well, don't do that, please, because that'll really hurt us. Meanwhile, UBS says that house prices, this will make you happy, show no signs of bottoming out. And they're now worse than the falls during the GFC. So lots and lots and lots of macro stuff all swirling around.
Mm-hmm.
We're the first to say that most of it probably doesn't matter, at least not for long-term investors. But the interest rate one is kind of interesting, right? So for the longest time, the RBA sat in their hands. I think it's the longest period without a move in rates, I think, in the RBA's history.
Mm-hmm.
They might yet be forced to go. If they do, when 25 basis points is kind of the generally accepted move, they're hoping it'll stop the risk, the spectre, to use the jargon, of deflation. Now, how bad could deflation get for the Australian economy?
So, okay, first, I think it'd be a bad move to cut the rate, given that our rates are higher than most of the other places,
yes. And
we borrow a lot of money from overseas.
We do.
There are other things that will happen, right? I mean, a lower rate might mean a lower dollar, which is, you know, good for exports,
yes. But
it's also not good for people wanting to spend money on travel and buy things, which are going to cost
more. You sound
more
like a bloke who's going overseas, sir.
I'm just saying. I'm just saying stuff.
I
think it's that. I think, you know, I think the hard way is to just, you know, do this unwinding of this binging that people have done. And we have all done this collectively as binging, you know, let's binge on the property prices that have gone up. Let's binge on the equity we have got. And the binge-a-thon, right? I mean, you need to unwind the binge-a-thon. And anything to help the binge-a-thon further is only going to, I think, you know, do you want a slow decline or do you want a bust, right? I mean, that's the question. I think that's maybe the question also RBA is thinking about. So I don't know. I'd say with a little bit higher probability that RBA is not going to cut rates.
Yeah.
That's my thinking. I'm in the not rate cut camp.
I'm in the RBA should raise rates before now camp. Frankly, I've been calling for months, maybe even years now, for higher rates more quickly. I think the emergency levels that we've been at were way too low and unsustainably low. The problem the RBA has is they didn't do anything then. And as you say, they now got themselves into a position where this is not actually about house prices at all. This is about, so deflation is one of those things that no one really understands particularly well because we haven't had deflation in the longest time, right? Where we've come out of 20 years of kind of, you know, inflation out of control. And then the last 10 or 15 years, we've got inflation under control. The risk is that we end up in deflation. Now, here's the problem with deflation, right? If I say to you, look, you know, why don't you buy something now? Let's pick my car, right? Buy my car off me now. You're going to say normally, well, okay, that seems like a good deal. It's a decent price. Okay, I'll buy it. Inflation might be a couple of percent, but that's fine. I'll buy the car. If we have deflation, in other words, prices are going to go down over time, you're going to say, well, hang on, I'm not going to buy you a $10,000 car today. I'm going to wait 6 months. I'm going to pay $9,500 for it because we know prices are going to fall in the future. Now, if that's the case, What happens? Everyone stops spending on the big stuff. So no one's going to invest any money on plant infrastructure, equipment, large assets because, I mean, you've got to buy food, of course, you can do that. But why bother buying anything that's going to be expensive if you know that in 6 months' time it's likely to be cheaper? And once deflation sets in, that really can put a hole right through the middle of an economy. So I kind of get, you know, for the long time I've been saying the ABS should increase rates. I'm going to say that they missed that opportunity, but right now I think they have no chance but to decrease rates, because if we get another quarter of negative, or there wasn't another quarter, it was exactly flat, but if we get a quarter of deflation, they're on the hook now for all of a sudden an economy that may be looking to kind of, frankly, fall in a bit of a heap. I don't know they can afford not to do anything really in that environment, even though I wish they'd had rates higher to start with so they can put rates down to a more reasonable level. I kind of feel like they're stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, inflation is pretty low all around the world, right? I mean, Okay, there's like, you know, between 1% and 2% in most places. Right?
But that's not deflation. That's a whole different story.
That's a whole different story. But, you know, it's close to zero. It's not negative. It's only one number that we've seen. Do you act on that, really?
Can you afford not to? That's the question.
I don't know. Like, I think the thing is that if you get a negative number and then you act, maybe that's enough.
Maybe. And that's certainly the view of those who say they should keep rates on a hold.
Yeah.
We will see. Interestingly enough, though, in this rate talk, NAB CEO has come out and I won't say desperate, but kind of looking a little bit desperate, saying, no, please don't cut rates. It's bad for our margins. At some point, the general idea with banking, and it's largely proven out by history, the higher rates are, the higher bank profit margins, because they've kind of got more room to go. The lower rates are, the lower the bank margins, because they just simply don't have enough room to play to kind of get cheap deposits. So NAB CEO, Cronican, coming out saying, well, maybe you could do more on tax or fiscal policy or something else, but please leave rates alone because it's really going to hurt our bottom line. Should we be worried about the bank's bottom lines in a world of lower rates?
There's a couple of things here. So I'll take a counter view and say that, you know, one of the things in NAB's result, and actually in ANZ's report, was that the mortgage delinquencies are actually on the rise, right? So which means people are not able to make those payments.
Yep.
If you cut the rate, actually, maybe they'll be able to make that
payment. That's true, right? That's true, yeah.
So it's actually helped that. So it's one of those things where, you know, something is going to hurt, but something is going to help.
Careful what you wish for. Exactly. Right, yeah.
So it's not, you know, again, I don't think you should cut rates yet, but I think the argument that, you know, if you cut rates and it's bad for my margins, I think that's a very poor argument.
Isn't it? It kind of feels a little bit desperate, I've got to say.
It's a desperate argument. And I think, you know, they're missing the bigger picture that maybe it helps somewhere else and therefore it's not that big a deal. Do you want write-offs on your book or do you want to actually have less margins?
Man, when that's your choice, you know you're in some trouble, right?
Yeah, that's a bad choice.
Now, speaking of which, so this is the other story from NAB this week. NAB slashed its dividend, not by a couple of percent, not by a little bit as people were expecting, but they took 16% off the dividend. The interim dividend, we call it in the jargon, the half-yearly dividend, was 99 cents last year. This year, they've only declared 83 cents. And some concern, or some frankly forecasting, that'll be the full year dividend as well. That's a pretty significant, you know, chomp out of the dividend for a bank that hasn't been doing it all that well. Got wrapped over the knuckles pretty hard at the Royal Commission. Cost them a couple of senior execs, a chairman and a CEO, no less. What do you make of NAB's dividend cut, mate? Is this too little, too late? Is it the right medicine for the right problem? How do you think about the banks in the wake of this particular cut?
So I think it's a good move. Like, I mean, in the case of NAB,
there's a whole lot of people on dividend incomes that are yelling at you right now.
But I mean, what do you want? Do you want a bank to exist and pay you a dividend in the future, or do you want a dividend now and not the bank in the future?
Can I have option three, please?
This looks like the two options to me right now. So I think this, you know, taking the bitter medicine now seems to be the right. I mean, they've inflated their share count. You know, people do share buybacks. They've been printing shares to, you know, through their dividend reinvestment plans and so on. So
and they're ramping that up again, by the way.
Yeah. So if that's happening, then you have you have more shares and you have the same amount of money to go around. You've got a problem. So they're cutting that. They've also got to pay, thanks to the Royal Commission, they've got to pay a few fines here and some, you know, exit payments to, I guess, former CEOs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, they've got a few payments to make as well, right? So capital requirements, spreading the income or the cash income that you've got across the dividend, or across the shareholder base. I mean, you know, I think it's a prudent move. Would I like it if I'm a shareholder? No. Definitely not. I hate it. But I think that was a good move. Yeah. Like, from a management point of view, well, I mean, that's a sane move, right?
We can call it lots of jargon so far this podcast. The old sustainable footing, right? They're now on a dividend level that they kind of feel like, in theory, as long as nothing gets horribly bad, and it still could, they feel like they can sustain this level of dividend on an ongoing basis. They've kind of realized, hey guys, we've been living on borrowed time for too long. Time to pull the reins in a little bit and say, look, you know what? Maybe we can afford 99 cents. Maybe we can't. Maybe we run into some trouble. Maybe we don't. Let's just cut it now. Get some more cash in through the dividend reinvestment plan and just basically try and right the ship a little bit. Give us a bit more dry powder when it comes to things that might come down the pike, including more costs from the Royal Commission, including a weaker economy potentially. You don't want to be going out cap in hand when things are already tough, right? You want to go and do it in the relatively good times. Now it's probably a pretty decent time to give it a go.
I agree.
Mate, this is going to be a bit of a downer start to this podcast because...
It's not. I mean, how is 9% fully franked or something like that? Or, you know, if you add the franking, isn't it 9%?
Yeah, well, 9.7%, I think.
Yeah, how much is it now?
No, that's what it is now.
How's that bad? How is that? I mean, 9% income. That's not bad. I mean, that's
That'll
great.
Pay the bills.
I mean, that's great.
That'll
I mean,
pay the bills.
I don't know. As you said, I think that's good.
The problem is, I now have to talk about Flight Centre.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
We started with the economy and rate cuts and then and deflation.
Yeah.
Then we went to NAB and NAB's problems and house prices. I want to have something positive to say, but I kind of don't yet because Flight Centre released its results or updated its results this week. Mm. The results were pretty ordinary and the culprit was the Australian leisure traveller. We're simply not spending enough money at flight. Everyone around the west of the world is. But Australians have stopped spending money at Flight Centre. Is this a kind of sign of the times, to your point about the kind of mortgage delinquency? Is this a case of people jumping online and booking with Webjet and everyone else, Expedia and those guys, booking directly? Why is Flight Centre struggling in its Australian business? What's going on?
I mean, I'll be hypothesizing here. So, I mean, you know, I was going to make some jokes and say that, you know, Flight Centre hit this turbulence or it hit an air pocket.
A rough landing.
Rough landing, almost like, or we can say crashed. But I mean, you know, it's what making $300 million and it's proposing to make $300 million in profit.
Shareholders, please put your tray tables up and put your seatbacks in the upright position.
We are going to make a hard landing now. Well, $300 million.
Flight 10 speeds, please be set for takeoff or landing or something.
From my small, you know, sampling is from my small sample, I have not seen people actually cut back on holidays. Yep. I actually know everybody's taking holidays and they're going to places and stuff like that. But maybe the problem is real in the sense that, you know, if people maybe are doing less overseas holidays, maybe that's one of the things that Flight Centre is saying. That makes sense. You know, if your dollar has weakened and, you know, you're going overseas and maybe you're going to America and it's just harder, a little bit harder.
Yep.
It's not impossible. It's a little bit harder. And those things on the edges maybe matter. That and then maybe people are not feeling as flush with cash. Maybe some people are on negative equity. Yeah. So all those things, I think, maybe add. And then, you know, maybe in this business, if everybody, like, you know, if the airline is making less because it wants to sell the seats, then, you know, everybody is progressively making less on that margin, right? So maybe that hurts. And maybe there's more, you know, a combination of things. Maybe people are just going and searching on Webjet or Expedia or, you know, booking.com and, you know, whatever else exists out there, right?
Yeah.
Thousands of alternatives. I mean, it's a tough one. I mean... Yeah. On the other hand, I mean, you know, you're still making $350 million. That's
not struggling for a quid, are they? Let's be honest.
They're not struggling for anything here. Also, the other thing to keep in mind, I mean, the shares fell, but the shares were also priced at a pretty reasonably high PE. They were like for 20 plus PE or something like that, right?
I want to call that out, actually, mate, because that's, you know, we're going to talk about this a little bit in passing, but it's where you've got to be really careful about the business and the stock.
Yeah.
Right? And the expectation, the investing is an expectations game, as it should be, as it must be. The future is what it's all about, right? So if we think forward and say, well, how much am I going to pay for Flight Centre shares? That's going to depend on what I expect the future to look like. And generally speaking, the faster you're growing, the more you're prepared to pay for shares because, hey, I'm getting more income in the future. I should be, you know, if I'm getting a dollar a year for the rest of my life, that's different if I'm getting a dollar this year, then $1.10, then $1.20, then $1.30. I'm going to start paying more for that second income stream because it grows in future, right? That's exactly how the market should work. And there's a big difference between, is Flight Centre's business in any trouble? No, absolutely not. It's in ruddy good health. But is it growing fast enough? As fast as it wants to? Probably not, knowing Screw Turner. But secondly, the share price assumes a level of growth. And this is where there's a big, big, big divergence. You can pay... I mean, it's hard to pay a low enough price for a terrible business, but you can buy a mediocre business for a really, really cheap price and do well.
Yeah.
And you can pay way too much for even the best business, maybe not the best business, but one of the best businesses in the world, because simply at some point, everything's about investment, right? And so there is that sense of, you know, we talk about Flight Centre as if the business is somehow in, well, we don't necessarily, but people are somehow in trouble, right? Flight Centre's terrible performance, blah, blah, blah.
And it's not in trouble.
Right. And it's not even really a terrible performance. I mean, it's not growing as fast as it would like to. Again, the company would like to, shareholders would love it to, but that's very, very different. And this is the key, because I'm not saying, by the way, they're off the hook or even that shareholders are off the hook. It's just important to remember there's a very, very big difference between the company itself and the price you're prepared to pay for the shares. That difference is where, frankly, investment fortunes are made and lost.
Yeah.
If you pay way too much for even just an average business, right? Like or even a good business, but just simply paying well over the odds. Woolies comes to mind, right? $38 a share. Was it 4 or 5 years ago? Fell to $20 after that because the margin was simply unsustainably high. Now, Woolies was never in any trouble. It was doing fantastically well as a supermarket. It's still Australia's biggest supermarket business, all that stuff. It just wasn't delivering the sorts of growth and margins that investors had, A, come to get used to, and B, expected in the future. And that's the problem when you extrapolate stuff. You've got to be very, very careful to make sure you're paying the right price for the right business.
I want to ask you a quiz question here.
And you, the answer is six, mate. You're welcome. Let's move on. All right, ask me your quiz question.
Do you know how much is the total sales on a trailing basis for Woolies?
Oh, I used to know this. I worked at Woolies years ago. I'll say $32 billion.
I think it's somewhere around $50 billion. Oh, so I mean, okay. My point really is that business is not in trouble. Really.
That's right.
We are buying a lot of stuff from Woolies.
That's right. There you go, $50 billion. That's not a bad little
I think off the top of my head. I haven't checked, but I think it's 50 billion.
You can't ask me a quiz question and not check it and tell me I'm wrong. Jeez, tough crowd.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Now, mate, I talked about some bad news early on, and we kind of talked about flights and other things. Let's go to a bit of good news, at least for now. AMP, well, I'll start with AMP, right? I'll start with the bad news, get that out of the way, and then hopefully we can then move on. AMP came out this week and said, well, look, people are still taking their money away, but trust us, we'll be okay by 2022.
That's a long way away.
Isn't it? And with no guarantee of success. That's kind of one of those, you know, talk about kicking the can down the road. It's like the football team rebuilding. We're rebuilding for 2022. Just stick with us. We'll get there. Maybe they will. Maybe they won't. I am not a huge fan of AMP, but interesting this week, partly because of AMP's woes, partly because of the excitement factor of this other company, one of these businesses just overtook AMP in market cap stakes. And that business is another kind of related business, if I draw a really long bow. It's in the financial services sector. And this is Afterpay, the buy now, pay later poster child, is now worth more in total than AMP. It blows my mind on both scales or on both counts. AMP was once this massive, it was the only national name in financial services, effectively. I mean, NAB was around, Commonwealth Bank was around as a government business. The other banks were large. I mean, Westpac was the Bank of New South Wales. St George was its own business, IMB, State Bank, all these things were state businesses. AMP was the national name in financial services. It had every opportunity to capitalize on all of the trends we've seen ever since. You know, in the last 30 years, it should be the biggest business in Australia by a decent margin by now. Unfortunately, we can't exactly say that because it's done exactly the reverse. And Afterpay has taken over, has taken the crown. It is now worth more than AMP. Again, we can kind of talk on either direction there. Let's start with AMP. Given this kind of, you know, currently low price, are you tempted at all to have a look at that and say, well, there's a price for everything. At some point, maybe the pessimists have taken over. Is AMP worth buying yet, do you think?
So, you know what? I'm not a value investor, and I'm definitely true. Not a deep value investor. In my experience, I don't get those things right, and I just stay away.
Right.
And as you said, there's a price for it, but you know, I don't know what exactly that price is.
Right.
And so I pass.
That's fair. So then let's go to Afterpay. Afterpay, the very, very, not, could never be accused of being a value investment. So maybe this is one that's more in your wheelhouse. Does AMP deserve a market cap that's greater than AMP's?
Well, I mean, you know, again, so it still matters. You know, you need to have a good sense of what AMP should be worth, which I, you know.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah, I'm not in a position. But is Afterpay...
Mate, the story is much more exciting if you just directly compare them, okay? Just pretend you don't have to worry about all the basics, you know.
Okay. just, you know, the nuances.
Theater of the mind here, mate. Yeah, we can make it up ourselves.
The nuances don't matter, said Captain Phillips. And we move on.
So put it this way. AMP is worth $6.5 billion. Afterpay is worth more than $6.5 billion. Is Afterpay really worth $7-ish billion?
Yeah, I guess maybe the way to think about this is that AMP probably has a net income, maybe still positive. I don't know if it is positive or not.
Probably have to make a few adjustments to one-offs and underlyings and stuff, but you maybe can get there.
Okay,
maybe.
Adjusted one-off special...
Basically, that's how you get there.
Well, Afterpay does not have any of those things. So, So here's the thing, right? Afterpay is a disruptive company.
Yes.
And, you know, I've been on the fence or on the other side of this for a long time, but I think one of the mistakes here is that technology enables a lot of different things, and you know, technology enables sort of exponential growth of different of uptake of different things, of new opportunities and so on. So I think Afterpay is a company that is using technology revolution to create new opportunities, right? And it's taken by a storm here in Australia, and they've made some very good moves in the US. The American market is at least 10x, maybe more, bigger than our market, right?
That's big.
So they have a big market opportunity. They've got a young founder, owner, leader in the driving shoes, in the driving seat, sorry. And and it's a product that consumers or its users actually love, right?
This is one of those things, right? Because the likes of Flexi Group has been out there for years. Thorn's been out there for years. It's not like there was no opportunity to...
Those were hated.
Well, that's right. Yeah. I mean, Flexi Group was Flexi Rent originally, and there was a Certegy Easy Pay brand, which Certegy as a name, whoever came up with that should be fired and never allowed to invent a name again. But you've been able to, the whole Harvey Norman, 50 months interest free. Yeah. These kind of ideas are really, really old ideas.
Yeah.
As you said, the Flexi Group shares have been in the doldrums for the longest time because people kind of hated the idea of this kind of, well, I'll call it buy now, pay later. It's a little bit different, but effectively same kind of idea, right? Take it home today, pay it off over the next X number of years or whatever. All of a sudden, Afterpay comes along. Not only does it capture the investor's attention, it captures consumer attention in a really fascinating, fascinating way. I've never used Afterpay. I don't think I'll ever use Afterpay because, frankly, if I've got the money, I'm not going to bother trying to pay it over three fortnights or 3 weeks, whatever it is, because I can't be bothered. And the difference in cost is nothing. If I'm buying a $50 pair of jeans, the interest I save in my offset account's probably, 25 cents or something. So I'm not going to bother. But people just love the hell out of this thing.
So I think one of the things that we underestimate is the power of removing friction. I think this is really underestimated. I think what they've done is made it really frictionless to A, get an account, A, get the borrowing power from them without, much, you press a few buttons and you get it. it works on your phone seamlessly.
Yeah.
They made the experience so easy.
So I was going to ask you, is it removing friction, which I agree with you, by the way, or is it just they've made it, they've almost gamified this whole idea? The fact it's on the phone. So it's like Apple Pay or Google Pay, right? Yeah. Like I use Google Pay and I kid myself that it's convenient, but then I think, well, I've got the phone in one pocket and my wallet in the other pocket. I can pull out a card as easy as use my phone, but I use my phone and I'm sure part of that is me just feeling like it's kind of fun and interesting and kind of cool to use the phone rather than the card. Like I'm really serious. The effort of both is exactly the same. There's no more or less friction with either payment. I'd rather use one because I feel like it's more fun or interesting or something that kind of leads me to want to do it. Is that the Afterpay effect?
I think, use the Google Pay example. I think that I would say it's again friction removal because the cards that I have on my Apple Pay.
Yep.
I do not actually physically have them in my wallet.
Right.
I've just thrown them away.
But I actually have both. That's what I'm saying. Like I'm literally carrying right now. I'm picking out of my pocket.
But you don't.
Mine, my wallet, right?
But you don't need to.
But I could. That's what I'm saying.
But why would you? Why would you do it? It's so easy. I go to the drive-thru and I, McDonald's drive-thru, let's use as an example, and I just, tap over my watch and I pay and I move on.
No, I understand. What my,
it
my,
is secure.
My, but my point
it's
is,
brilliant.
If I have both already, if I have them in my pocket now.
Friction. Life is all about removing friction.
But I could, it's not, extra friction of either.
You can go from Sydney to Melbourne on a bullock cart or a horse cart. You could walk. Why do you take the plane? you know, it's like one of those things.
My point is I've got them both in my pocket right now. Yeah. The act of paying with either the phone or the card is literally the same. There's no less friction, right? For me right now, you don't carry your wallet. That's cool. I carry both. And, you know, I still use my phone because I think for me, the kind of gamification, the appification, the kind of cool factor is worth something to me intrinsically, right? If I'm honest with myself, the fact I'm paying with the phone is partly just kind of being a bit of a wanker.
So back to Afterpay, like comparing with, say, Flexi Group or something else, yep, or Harvey Norman, there's no really credit checks that, you know, they're doing everything online, yep, automatically, quickly.
Even like FPOS, right? I could use an FPOS card.
But in this case, people are actually borrowing, right? I mean, this is basically bringing forward, you know, your buying power.
So you reckon there's literally people who couldn't have bought the jeans otherwise?
Well, there are some. Right. There's some that for some it is cool.
So, all right. I don't think maybe I'm never going to get Afterpay. Is it worth $7 billion? That's my question.
Well, okay. So Afterpay, I would say, is a risk investment, which if it pans out, if it becomes the I don't know, let's use an example. If it becomes the Visa or MasterCard, mm-hmm, of the paying later, yes, then it could be worth a lot more.
But if my grandmother had wheels, she'd be a bicycle.
Might.
It's very possible. So, are you confident? Are you comfortable? Are you optimistic for Afterpay, or do you think the market's going to be carried away?
Well, I'm optimistic. Let me put it this way. I am cautiously optimistic in the sense that I think it's a risky investment for anybody who owns it.
Right.
Anybody who owns it needs to realize this is a very high risk investment, which, you know, has, you know, it could be a multi bagger, mm-hmm, or it could crash in half. Right. Okay. And again, if you're looking at that sort of opportunity, mm, if you can go up 3-5x from here, if it goes up, you know, 3-5x, you know, still only a $35 billion company, again, $35 billion Australian, which you know, if you compare to some of the other financial services companies of today's age, it's you know, relatively similarly sized or smaller, right? So I don't know, I think there's a good upside potential here, good multiplier potential. It's a very high risk investment, I would say. And, you know, I would just say watch your allocation, basically. You know, this is not a company that I would own a lot of,
yeah,
because of that risk.
Yeah, nice.
And if it goes up multifold, then, you know, owning a little bit is probably enough.
It's pretty solid. I'm probably not going to buy Afterpay, I've got to tell you, mate, but I may well be left sitting in the gutter while you ride off in your brand new Tesla Model S.
You should just buy some Apple shares. Let's start there.
Oh, God. Here we go.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, let's move from the sublime to the something less. We're talking about Wesfarmers as we opened up the podcast. And we talked a couple of weeks ago, maybe it was even last week. It feels, mm-hmm, like a long time ago. Wesfarmers tried to buy Lynas. That didn't quite work. Undeterred, CEO Rob Scott has now made a bid for Kidman Resources from mineral sands, from rare earths, to lithium. Speaking of Teslas, it is all of a sudden all about mining for Wesfarmers. And this is kind of, I mean, Wesfarmers has always had some degree of kind of commodity exposure, right? They've had mining for the coal mining for the longest time. They've had some exposure to things like industrial chemicals. Mm. But lithium mining is a pretty big jump, even rare earths mining. This is, at best, I can say, well, they're staying true to some sort of form. They're having some of their exposure on their diversified investment company to mining broadly. Or I can say, this is supposed to be the bottom drawer conservative century-old stock that most mum and dad investors put in the bottom drawer because it's going to be a stable, solid performer, not shoot the lights out, but do okay. And all of a sudden, they're getting to lithium mining where the prices of not only the commodity, but the shares have been all over the joint over the last couple of years. Is Wesfarmers throwing off the cloak of conservatism, or are they simply trying to diversify themselves into a bit of something just to keep that spread of investment returns coming?
You know, my first thought when I read this was that maybe they've got too much money to spend. So I was thinking I was thinking of writing an email to them saying, you know, how about you give me some?
What would you do with it? Other than buy yourself a Tesla?
Oh, I'd buy a boat, maybe.
You're not going to invest it for them, you're just going to spend it.
No, of course. Okay. Like, I mean, I think that's a much better use. Maybe
dear Wesfarmers, please give me some cash.
Yeah, and I will spend I'll spend it at Flight Center. It'll help Flight Center. So that was my first thought. I said, I don't know, these guys are really itching to spend some cash, was my... Yeah.
Mate, just quietly, the amount of money I spend at Bunnings, if they sent me some money, I'd probably spend it at Bunnings. It's probably good for the share price. So some sort of virtuous circle there. Just send me some more cash, I'll buy some more stuff from Bunnings. Exactly. The shares will go up, everyone's happy.
So, I don't know. It's one of those things. Like, I mean, maybe they're very competent. I mean, the thing is that there aren't many competent mining companies. Like, I mean, Woolies as well, Rio,
yeah.
And you know, BHP, maybe South 32. But who else? I mean, it's with you know, there are not many of them, right? So yeah. I don't know. I mean,
I just think lithium, right? Like, I know lots of lithium using lots of electric cars. I get the trend, but man, like, it's just this reminds me of the old graphene boom, the old nickel boom, the kind of.
The lithium-ion battery requirement is probably going to go up a lot.
Oh, yeah, so, totally.
I mean, that's true. But that's
the demand side, right? If you find a bit more lithium around the world, the price still comes back
But lithium is not rare.
Yes, exactly. Right.
So lithium is not, it's not like, you know, it's hard to find lithium, right? So, I mean, you can go and dig.
I mean, because at some point, there's some, you've got to be able to get it close enough to a port. It's got to be accessible enough at low enough cost. But I take your point, right? It's like rare earths. Rare earths aren't actually rare, nor is lithium.
You know, I don't know. Will you be able to compete with a Chinese miner in China?
Right.
Probably all the batteries are going to be produced, right? I mean, you know, those are the sort of things. So
crazy, hey?
I don't know. And then you're beholden, as you said, to the sort of the price cycle or how, you know, the plants producing these things are coming on and off.
I mean, 2 years ago, Kipman was a 20 cent stock 2 years ago. Now, to be fair, a year ago, it was a $2 stock.
How much is the bid for?
Well, the price now about $1.86. So I can't.
And the bid is for what, $1.90?
$1.90, I think. Mm. But I mean, they're buying it kind of at the highs after all the, I don't know. I mean, I do. I respect Wesfarmers. I trust their management trying to do the right thing. It just feels like both rare earths and lithium, like, they're really chasing hard against some really hot stuff.
Yeah.
Rather than the traditional Wesfarmers would be buy the bombed out asset, countercyclically try and make some money on that. Like, they've been a pretty traditionally kind of conservative mob. Buying a lithium mine near an all time high. That's aggressive, I think.
If anything, I'll say this is perhaps a little less risky compared to buying Linus. I mean, Linus has got sovereign risk, a big one, a huge
massive,
one.
Massive.
So maybe this is, but you know, but
they're de-risking the portfolio by going after both.
But you know, I think they can just give me some money. And I think that will solve a lot of the problems.
That sounds like the answer.
That's the answer.
That's where we're going with this one. All right.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index. Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, we just finished talking about Wesfarmers and mining. We promised last week we talk a little bit about mining. So I'm going to try and give a couple of minute thought on how and why investors can, if they desperately need to, invest in mining. And then I'll get you to jump in and let me know where I'm getting it wrong. So here's the thing about mining, right? We know commodity prices are cyclical. We also know that commodity prices tend to be, well, more often than not, the commodities, because they're all substitutable. So you don't care whether you get your iron ore from Fortescue or BHP or Rio in Australia or Vale in South America or anybody else. A ton of iron's a ton of iron's a ton of iron, at least at the same grade. So the question comes down to, if you don't know what the price is going to be, how do you invest in a miner? Now, first thing I will say is people will tell you they know what the price is going to be or where it's going somehow. Good luck with that. I think that's a really, really aggressive and frankly risky way to try and invest. I'd actually call it speculation rather than investing. If you're relying on the fact that you think somehow that the iron ore price will be 20% higher in 3 months' time, good luck with that one, because I don't know anyone who can do that reliably. But if that's your thing, then I guess I can't stop you, so I won't stop you, but just be very, very careful. Here's how to think about mining. So firstly, I think we'd agree that no one needs to have mining stocks in their portfolio. For all of the talk about diversification, diversification doesn't mean two of everything. It just means a broad range of risks in your portfolio, so that no one company, one sector, one set of risks will bring your portfolio down. So that's what diversification means. It doesn't mean buy some of everything. I think the second thing I'd say is for those who want to, then even despite that, still do it. The safest way, the lowest risk way of doing it, and I'll say lowest, not low, because they're different things. It's always going to be risky, is to buy the miner when the commodity price is near the marginal cost of production. And let's unpack that just a little bit. So if you're going to buy a miner, let's pick an iron ore miner. The iron ore price has fluctuated between about $35 and about $100 a ton over the last 5 years. Pick a number, right? So if you know the range is that big and you don't know what the price is going to be in the future, how do you give yourself the best chance of doing well? The answer is that the marginal cost of production is, in other words, the cost of producing the last ton of iron ore required by the market. That's the marginal cost, right? So the cheap stuff gets produced first, then the more expensive stuff, then the more expensive stuff, and the cost curve goes up. And eventually when the market wants, let's pick a low number just to be silly, 100 tons of iron ore in a given year. The first 10 tons comes out at $15 a ton because it's super cheap, super abundant, super available, near the port, all that kind of good stuff. The next 10 tonnes comes out at $20 a tonne, the next 10 at $30 a tonne in terms of the cost, because it's harder and harder to get to, or they're lower quality, lower scale miners. For a whole lot of reasons, that's the case. The 100th tonne comes out, and let's say it costs $45 a tonne to get out of the ground. Just pick a number. If you know that, then effectively what you're saying is no one can produce enough tonnage at less than that price. Now, if the price is $100 a tonne, that $55 gap is everyone else's profit opportunity, right? Or you and I could go and grab a backhoe, drive it over to WA and start digging, and we could probably produce iron ore for less than $100 a tonne. So at that price, every man and his dog with a shovel a shovel and a grader can get into the iron ore business. And what happens? Well, when you get a lot of supply coming into the market, the price should and will fall back. On the flip side, when the price goes to $40 a tonne, that $45 a tonne mob that's producing the last tonne stops producing. And so what happens? Well, the price will go up because more supply is required, and more supply will come on stream to fill that demand. This is kind of hard to do in words, but hopefully I'm doing it reasonable justice. So if you know that last tonne costs $45 a tonne, you want to buy when the price is closer to $45 than a higher price. You want to buy at $48, $50, $52 a tonne, because you know that as the price falls lower, supply is going to come out of the system, which should push prices up. In other words, the closer your price is to the marginal cost, the less margins being made, the greater the chance the price won't fall materially further than that for a decently long period of time.
I'm going to ask you a couple of questions.
Shoot, please.
Make
me sound smart.
I have made no mining investment till date that has actually made me money.
Right.
So clearly I'm missing a trick or two here. Mm-hmm. Question number one is, if you knew the marginal cost, mm-hmm. A, maybe knowing it is difficult, mm-hmm. and maybe the people, people at West Farmers should know the marginal cost of mining.
They
if they know the ore, or people at Rio or BHP, mm-hmm. and they should therefore be the richest people, because they should be able to buy when it is at the marginal cost, the stocks, and then basically.
Historically, by the way, BHP's done exactly that, but keep going.
Okay, so that's part one of my question. How do you know what is the marginal cost mm-hmm. of a particular type of mining?
Yes.
And B, how do you know when to exit?
Yep, great questions. And this is where, frankly, the answers to those are as uncertain as you are insinuating, and exactly why we don't invest in mining, generally speaking, because in some of these cases, buying is actually the easier decision. Selling is really, really, really hard. Mm. So how do you know the marginal cost? The answer comes down to industry knowledge, and that can either be private knowledge or public knowledge. In the case of iron ore, for example, it's relatively easy to find the marginal cost of production. There's plenty of data out there. You kind of know roughly what that is. But the easy way to do it, frankly, and iron ore is super easy because the market is it's relatively dominated by a few big players. Rio, Fortescue, BHP, Vale, their costs are relatively well known. They're all in cash costs, as they're called. And if they're producing the lion's share, they're almost the marginal producers, not quite, but you get a pretty good sense of where that is. I throw in a couple of others, you can get to that marginal cost pretty quickly. When you start talking about lithium or something else, this is when it gets really, really tough. And back to your West Farmers question, that's why I think they're nuts, because this market is not a stable market. We don't know what the long-term... the long-term demand of iron ore is relatively stable, right? It'll grow at a couple of percent a year for the foreseeable future, because all of the iron ore kind of market, the need for iron ore, whether it's steel making, whether it's whatever, that's already kind of factored in. That's not going to change dramatically anytime soon. Now, the lithium market, frankly, everyone's excited about electric cars. And so a lot of people are going to pile into mining lithium because they feel like that's the future. In fact, the marginal cost is probably going to come down over time. That's going to be really, really careful.
So I have a third question for you.
Shoot.
How is there a role for, say, and maybe there is, technology for reducing the marginal cost? I mean, maybe today it is $20 a ton for, say, iron ore. Maybe, maybe 5 years from now, it's actually 15.
Yes, totally. And over time, traditionally, the marginal cost has been relatively stable, even as volumes grow, for exactly that reason. Because people have got, and it's, when you say technology, it's absolutely technology. It's actually more, at least historically, it's been more production scale than pure technology.
Okay.
So the incremental return from digging an extra ton out of a ground of an existing mine is much less than the average cost, right? Because you've got to put the infrastructure in place, you build the buildings, you buy the machines, you do whatever you're doing. Those kind of fixed costs are relatively fixed, funnily enough, as you'd expect. The cost of the land, all that kind of stuff is fixed. The physical incremental cost, the variable cost of an extra ton of iron ore is pretty low, because all you got to do is drive the machine for an extra hour, pay the workers for an extra hour. You don't buy a second machine. You don't put more buildings up. You don't buy a second plot of land. You just keep digging. And so that does change scale-wise. Technology, absolutely. So self-driving trucks, self-driving trains are absolutely lowering the cost of production. Better refining techniques absolutely lower the cost of production. So those things are absolutely real. Traditionally, because there's a huge, huge, huge volume operations, it tends to be scale rather than tech that makes the biggest difference. So if you compare BHP and Rio getting it out of the ground at $15 a ton, like they're just super, super cheap producers. But the smaller ones, the Atlas Iron of the world, those kind of guys, frankly, go out of business in the bad times because their costs are so much higher. They're smaller. They have less technology. They're simply less able to scale those benefits. And frankly, iron ore, just to give a quick tangent, often described as a transport business with an iron ore mine at the end rather than a true mining business.
Right.
The cost of getting it to the port and to the customer is largely higher cost than actually the digging out of the ground because it's so abundant, so available. So for what it's worth, that's the way to think about it. You asked about when to sell, just to wrap this up. The answer is no one knows because if you're buying it, you're buying it hoping to make more money in the future.
Mm.
How much higher does the price have to go? If I was going to do this and I don't, I'd be selling opportunistically when I'd made a decent amount of money on the basis of the further the price gets away from the marginal cost, the lower your probable risk adjusted returns, if you like. In other words, if the iron ore price, say the marginal cost is $40, at $50 a ton price, you're making $10 a ton. The downside is reasonably small because it's only going to fall back a little bit before it hits that marginal cost.
Mm-hmm.
When it gets to $80, then you're going to say, well, the chance of going to 120 versus going back to 40 starts to look a little bit more like even money. And so I think, again, we don't recommend them, and I don't know that we ever would, but certainly we'd be looking for, once the price had moved materially away from the marginal cost, we'd probably say, well, we might be leaving money on the table, we might not. But the thesis would be effectively almost a value investing thesis, which is simply when I get a re-rating, to use a horrible term, in other words, if the price goes up, great, tick that box, sell and move on, hopefully bank some profits. That's how I'd be doing if I was going to invest in mining companies.
This is a great education for me. You know when I'm going to buy mining? I'm going to buy mining when Jeff Bezos starts mining lithium in outer space.
Oh, is he going to do that?
Maybe. When he starts, he has his outer space.
You heard it first, fools?
Yeah. So that's when I'm going to buy mining.
Mate, I'm probably with you. I've got to say, I went really close to recommending, I think I might have said, a gold mining company for ShareAdvisor a few years ago. Evolution Mining was the company. Its costs were really low. The price of gold was much higher than that, and it was mining Australian dollars, the gold price in US dollars. It looked pretty attractive. It would have been a great investment in hindsight. But again, this is one of those stories where if you just look at a single example and say, see, I could have been a great mining investor, the chance I would have lost money on a million other things is pretty high as well. So sometimes it's better just to frankly stick within your circle of competence. Mining companies very, very rarely as a whole, as a group, make money for investors over the long term. It's often a sector just simply best avoided.
Great.
Mate, that's it.
That's it.
We've come to the end of this week's podcast.
So sad.
No time for mailbag. But the good news is next week, all mailbag, all the time.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm looking forward to that.
Make sure you tune in next week, fools. It's going to be pretty exciting. If you have any questions for us on our mailbag, of course, you can get in touch with us. info@fool.com.au is our email address. Or hit us up at Twitter @TMFScottP, @AnirbanMahanti, or @TheMotleyFoolAU. That's probably the simplest one of the lot. Hit us up with questions, comments, feedback. You can jump on our Facebook page as well. With any way you want to get in touch with us, we love to hear your comments, feedback, questions, ideas, suggestions. And a little bit of praise never goes astray, does it, mate?
Definitely not.
That's it. That does wrap us up for this week's Motley Fool Money. But before we go, don't forget you can subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast, and you should, through iTunes, or if you're a little more educated, your favorite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Leave us a review. Tell your friends. Let more people discover the wonderful Android-powered goodness that is Motley Fool Money. Can I say that?
Maybe.
He's given up. We're almost at the end. He's just going to sail on the sunset on this one. And don't forget, you can get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox by going to fool.com.au/MMM.
Triple M.
That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of mailbag enhanced foolish goodness. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.